Blog Talk Radio.
Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And this show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region. And as always, In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner is powered by the African American Athlete.com. And when you hear the African American Athlete.com, you think of one person and one person only, the founder, my producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we, in our tradition, will continue to keep the history and legacy of great basketball alive, especially DMV style. And in the Coach's Corner this morning, we have a guy that one of the more underrated players of all time. But let me tell you this. He was Dennis Rodman before Dennis Rodman. Boy, he could rebound. And as an old coach once told me, you can pass too much, you can shoot too much, and you can dribble too much. But you can never, ever rebound too much. And this guy was always looking for the rebound. Out of Western High School, he is Curtis Perry. Hey, Curtis, how are you?
How you doing, my man? I'm doing okay.
Fantastic. Well, Curtis, as I started off, man, you were Dennis Rodman before Rodman. You made a living just rebounding. Didn't care about points, although you could score. But you made a living rebounding. Talk about the importance of rebounding the basketball.
Well, one of the first things I learned was that that's how you could get playing time. And if you really want to be out on that court, get the ball off the board. You absolutely could assure yourself some time. And I had read, I don't even know if he said it or not, but I had read an article by Paul Silas where he had made a quote that he would try to touch every rebound that came off the board. And I knew it wouldn't be possible, but the mindset of just going after the ball, that made people like him, who he wasn't a great leaper or anything, he played by position. But the mindset to go after the ball, not just stand there and wait for it to come to you and off the board, but just get it. And since I couldn't dribble, pass, or shoot, it made for a nice spot on that Western team that played defense, blocking shots. I could really make layups, so. And tip in, so I had a spot.
Wow. Let's talk about being a late bloomer. And Curtis, I've said this, that if you're a big player, if you're someone that is 6'8 or above, it's almost advantageous to be a late bloomer. Can't be a late bloomer as a guard. You know, you have to come out of the cradle being Bo Scott or Larry Watson or Darnell Bullock or Von Kimbrough, just some of the great point guards, you know, back in the day. But If you're a big guy, you can get that late start because you don't develop bad habits. Talk about Curtis Perry, how you started playing, and you are definitely the epitome of what we call a late bloomer.
Well, my first year at Western, I went out for the varsity, but I had never played really organized basketball before. I played with my street buddies over on I Street. We played in the alley behind my house on Peach Basket. And mm-hmm. I could outjump everybody. And by the time I got to Western, I was, you know, that was my skill. And we had Andrew White on the team. He was the best player. And I thought, oh, no, I'm not ready for this. So I backed off of the varsity and went down to join the JV for playing time. And I knew right then that I'm not ready for this. But if I could play on the JV and learn how to play with four other guys on the court. And moving up to the varsity the next year, Andrew White was still the best player on the team, and I did my part with the rebounding. Garland Pinkston, who recently passed, was on that team.
Yes.
And Roland Merritt, who became a track star at Maryland, he was on the team. We had, and I figured, well, I could really help this team by getting it off the board. My senior year, when I was supposed to be the man, the best player on the team was Lamar McCoy. He and Larry Watson came to the team that year. I was a senior. They were both sophomores. But Lamar McCoy was the best player. I still wasn't offensive-minded. I wasn't assertive enough to be the team leader. And still feeling my way around this game called basketball. Mm-hmm. And plus I had gotten a couple of growth spurts. So by the time I left Western, I was 6'7". And Southwest Missouri State was one of the three scholarship offers I had. One to High Point, North Carolina, where Gene Littles, another D.C. product, went.
Yes.
And one to College of Eastern Utah, which I had no intentions of going there. And Southwest Missouri, where another D.C. player, who also was a late bloomer, Lou Shepard, who went to Dunbar. He was there. So I knew somebody at Southwest Missouri. It was another guy from D.C., so there was something in common I could relate to. And I wasn't even their first choice. Ernest Johnson from Fairmont Heights was the one that they were recruiting. And they didn't know that I had sprouted up to 6'7", and by the time I got to Southwest Missouri, freshmen could play also in college division, which is now Division II. Mm-hmm. And I worked my way into a senior-laden starting lineup. But I got playing time. I got exposure. I learned, and being on a team with mostly seniors, that was a learning experience. And I just kept learning and improving each year that I played.
Mm-hmm. Curtis Perry is in the coach's corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And Curtis, let's go back to basketball in D.C. in the 60s. It seemed like every team in the Inner High, and of course the Catholic Leagues, but the Inner High, Eastern, Spingarn and Anacostia on that side. But on the western side, Cardozo, Western, Bell, and then you had McKinley Tech. Everybody, Dunbar, everybody was stacked with at least two or three all-city caliber players. Talk about those times.
There, that was some of the best high school basketball there that I can remember in D.C. And the great Frank Morgan Wooten at DeMatha, they had just finished with my first teammate when I was on the San Diego Rockets was the great Bernard Williams from DeMatha, the original Spider-Man. And there was Collis Jones, St. John's, and Bob Whitmore at DeMatha, Austin Carr, Tom Little at the Mackin.
Hold it right there, because so many of our listeners, younger listeners or listeners who are outside of the DMV, they know about Austin Carr, okay? But a lot of them aren't aware of Tom Little. Talk about the brilliance of Tom Little. I really never saw Tom miss a shot. I'm telling you, he was that good.
He was super good. In fact, he was the number one player at Mackin. Austin Carr was number two.
That's right.
They had Richie Coleman. Richie Coleman was at Mackin. And Cardozo were loaded. Billy Gaskins, Ed Epps, Vaughn Kimbrough, Lynn Ring. Coolidge had Horace. I can't get his last name right now. But and Dunbar was loaded. Wendell Hart and
Bill
Ote.
And then Louis West for Eastern.
Eastern had the great Louis West. Yeah, and Spingarn was loaded. McKinley, oh my God, McKinley beat us in the beat Western in the playoffs that year. McKinley Tech had everybody.
they won the championship
They were so good. The Inner High was loaded, and the Catholic League was loaded, and the surrounding Virginia schools were loaded. I think it was the Hetzels at Landon.
It was Landon, yeah.
But and you would see these guys on the playground. We played outside mostly then. Turkey Thicket, Sherwood and Trinidad and Happy Hollow. You see these guys playing all summer on the outside courts, the lights on at 9 o'clock at night, and you lose, and you have to wait a couple of hours before you get your five back out there. The first time I saw Bobby Dandridge was at Sherwood in D.C., former Wizards great, Milwaukee Bucks teammate of mine. He came up from Norfolk, Virginia. Maggie Walker High School down there, which they were winners. The game was such that guys that were super talented and had played organized CYO mainly because the AAU stuff had not really kicked in yet. So the best way to get some experience was Catholic League basketball.
Well, Catholic League basketball and, of course, junior high school
and
basketball
high,
was
yeah.
so organized back then. And, of course, you had Francis, which was somewhat of a feeder school for
and
Western
Patterson.
And Cardozo.
And Garnet Patterson. Yeah. I had gone to Brown Junior High, and we didn't have much of an athletic program over there, but it definitely prepared me for high school as far as the academics are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Curtis Perry is our guest, and Curtis, I brought up the competition in the mid-60s in the D.C. area and, of course, the playgrounds, because when you are consistently going against that caliber of players, both during the season and during the summer, when you get to the next level, you have somewhat of a confidence and you're not intimidated by anything or anyone, correct?
That's correct. It definitely prepared me for my first year of really well, there's a saying that talent will seek its own level, and that what I was exposed to were players that were better than I was, more skilled than I was, and when you compete against that kind of talent, and you learn to harness I learned to harness my God-given talent. I could run like a deer. I could jump higher than anybody around me. And just learning to harness that talent took a little bit. So it didn't come overnight, and I had to work at it. And that was one of the main things. Putting in the work, the practice, the after school, the after practice, on my own, working on things. I was fortunate to have somebody work with me in high school. I was fortunate to have seniors around me to help me develop in college. And in the pros, I was fortunate enough to be on teams with Hall of Famers on it, and they would help you. You know, they might yell at you and call you a couple of names for throwing a bad pass, but you get to understand how to play basketball, how to play the game.
Mm-hmm. Expound a little more on harnessing your God-given skills, because it's obvious, late bloomers as yourself, that doesn't happen just through osmosis. It happens through hard work, as you just stated. Talk about your hard work, your work effort, work ethic, and your routine that you would do on a regular basis to get you ready to be an NBA caliber player.
Well, when I was in college, I started off as I make a whole bunch of layups. I did tip-ins, pretty much the same thing that I did in college, but I rebounded. I've got every rebounding record at Southwest Missouri because I knew that would keep me on the floor. And I had my inspirations with Bill Russell and Paul Silas, and I had seen David Latin when they came to Coalfield House to play Kentucky. And, man, it was a monster. But the very first person that I understood played somewhat like me was John Thompson, Big John Thompson.
Yeah.
He went to Carroll.
That's right.
Who wasn't really a great offensive player, but man, could he bound. He was a glass cleaner. And that guy is how I want to do it. And the offensive game, I would just shoot off the backboard on both sides of the court. And this is after practice. This is on my own. Keep working. Keep staying with what I did best, but add something and be determined each year, each practice, to be better than I was the last time out. And it works. It absolutely works.
In terms of rebounding, I listened to Dennis Rodman once, and Rodman would say he would come on the court early or after everyone had left and would rebound shots. And he would look at film, and he would look at the tendencies that if Michael Jordan shot a ball and if he missed, or the rare times he missed, where the ball would come off, or he would study angles in terms of rebounding. Did you do something similar?
What I did mainly was try to, I would throw the ball up off the board and go get it myself, and try to tip it in from where I caught it, or one step and dunk it from the lane, over and over. And then it helps if you got a guy on the team who likes to shoot. You tell him, I don't care if you miss. It's good for me. Not that it's a great thing to miss shots, but if you got a guy on the team who likes to cast him up there, then that just helps you. And it helps their confidence, too, when they're not afraid to shoot it, which is part of that team concept that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. What I did best was get the ball. And, I could throw it to Larry Watson or Lamar McCoy, or in college I could throw it to the guards, and in the pros, an abundance of people I could throw it to that knew much better what to do with it than I did, or understood how to do it. And the late bloomer concept, it only works if you're ready to work at it, to put some time in it, to do what is necessary to improve. And I wanted to stay in the league. I wanted to stay on the team. I wanted to make the team. And doing what I could to contribute meant that's how I could do it.
Wow. And, of course, you had a stellar career at Southwest Missouri State, and you were drafted in the third round, the 1970 draft, pick number 35 overall by the San Diego Rockets, but you were also drafted by the ABA team, the Virginia Squires. Was there a tremendous choice to make, or from day one you knew you wanted to go to the NBA?
Well, when I noticed that I was the things weren't quite like they are today. There was no big drafting program or anything.
No.
And my coach had to come over to my apartment and knock on the door and tell me that I got drafted. So I learned later that my future coach, Al Bianchi, was my assistant coach with the Suns. He was going to be coaching the Virginia Squires. And my teammates could have been George Gervin, Julius Erving, me, and Charlie Scott.
Wow. A lot of rebounding opportunities there.
There could have been a great bunch of rebounding opportunities. But I wanted to play in the NBA, and San Diego, maybe I should have listened to the offers from the ABA, but here was a chance to go to the NBA, and being the number 35 pick when there were only 18 teams that year, that indicated a little confidence in me that they had, well, that I had potential. Mm-hmm. And the ABA was just kind of getting going then. And thanks to Spencer Haywood, who he and Charlie Scott had just come off the 68 Olympic team where Spencer Haywood dominated the world and he paved the way for early entry. So there were these things going on, and the ABA was taking mostly underclassmen. They had there was this thing called hardship where you could apply to go play professional ball because of financial hardship, your family and everything. And the ABA was taking those players. Now, when we came out of college, you know, let's not forget that it was a different kind of basketball being played because of this guy who went to Powell Memorial in UCLA named Lou Alcindor, who had dominated the basketball scene in high school, and he was about to do the same thing in college. So they did came up with that. So the NCAA came up with the Alcindor rule where there was no dunking.
Yes.
Which also aided in my development because I had to learn how to play the game without just jumping up or throwing it down. So there was no dunking in college, no dunking in high school. You had to work on other aspects of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I got to Southwest Missouri, couldn't dunk because of number 33 at UCLA and team full of seniors, my desire to get better helped in my development for and preparation for the pros.
Yes,
plus, I grew another inch.
At the 6'8", 220. Now, Curtis, let's talk about, in most cases, unless you are a LeBron James, a Michael Jordan, a Elgin Baylor, someone like that, Bill Russell, Will Chamberlain, but most of your players who were gifted enough to make it to the highest level, the NBA, their success or failure depends on the system. You go to the Rockets, system maybe is not advantageous, but then you go to Milwaukee, and not only is the system perfect for you, but you become that one missing piece that they needed, and you guys roll all the way to the championship.
Well, Milwaukee had traded Greg Smith to the Rockets. The Rockets had moved from San Diego to Houston, and my first year I set an NBA record. I sat on the bench for 25 straight games without even taking my warm off.
Wow!
In fact, I'll tell you a little story. Me and Bernard Williams were planning on not putting on our uniforms under our warm-up one game because, I'm a silly rookie and Spider-Man wasn't playing either. But I lived in the apartment upstairs above him. And then we decided, it'd be just our luck that we go out there with nothing on under the warm-ups but our jockey strap, and we know we will get called on that game. We know we were doing good. And when I was on the Rockets, it was I played behind Rudy Tomjanovich, Elvin Hayes. I was the backup center to Elvin Hayes. And because I could jump and rebound, not because I was this great player, but that was my position. And I wasn't much of a fit. Even Rudy Tomjanovich didn't get the kind of playing time that he needed. And there was John Q. Trapp from UNLV and John Block from USC, Toby Kimball, who had led the nation in rebounding from Connecticut. And the coach was Alex Hannum, who was very old school and didn't believe in playing rookies. So there was really no fit on it. But I had my best game as a rookie against the Los Angeles Lakers, playing back up to Elvin Hayes. And they had a pretty good center named Will Chamberlain. And I had my best game as a rookie, 27 points, 23 rebounds against the Lakers.
And, what was that like? Please share that, because, I mean, not everyone gets the opportunity, first of all, to have witnessed Will play, but then to be on the court at the same time as a teammate, but in your case, as an opponent. Talk about the dominance and the greatness and the uniqueness of a Will Chamberlain.
Well, my first three games as a rookie, playing backup center, were against the San Francisco, soon to be Golden State Warriors. They had a pretty good center named Nate Thurmond.
Yes,
and the second game was against the Lakers. The third game was against Milwaukee. They had a real good center, Captain Hook. So the Lakers had Will Chamberlain, Jerry West, Gail Goodrich, Elgin Baylor, Happy Harrison, Pat Riley, and Milwaukee had Kareem, Oscar Robertson, Bobby Dandridge. San Francisco had Nate Thurmond and Jeff Mullins, the former Duke great. Boston and Dave Cowan, John Havlicek, Don Nelson was still playing, JoJo White, Don Chaney, Pete Maravich was in the league, the great Lou Hudson, Walt Bellamy, and New York, oh my goodness, Bill Bradley, Walt Frazier, Earl Monroe, Dave DeBuscher, Willis Reed. Did I leave out any Hall of Famers on that team?
Oh, I tell you, the point's well made. Sam Jones once told a story that Bill Russell told Michael Jordan when he made the pass to one of his teammates. It was either Paxton or Kerr, one of the two, who hit the winning shot. And the story goes that Russell told Michael, he said, back in my day, that play wouldn't have happened. And Mike said, well, Russ, what do you mean? He said, a guy like Paxton or Kerr would never have been in the league. And he was right, because, you know, as you stated, that there were only a handful of teams and 12 jobs, and a lot of guys playing today would not have been in the league then.
They would not have been in the league. I'm not putting them down
no.
for their talent or skill. It was just 18 teams and 12 guys on the team. And the opportunities to get on the court and secure a position, they were rare. You had to take advantage of every minute that you got. So there was no half-stepping, especially if you're a rookie or haven't been playing much. You better put the time in, because you could be gone, and there were a lot of eager people to take your place. It wasn't. But on the other hand, I had people, and there was a sense of camaraderie among the people who were in the league, even playing at your position, that would help you out, would tell you how to prepare to play, what it is you needed to do to improve. I can't say enough about John Q. Trapp, who was my mentor, so to speak, at San Diego, or Dandridge in Milwaukee, and Oscar and Kareem. Guys that would, hey, look, they come over, they talk to you. Oscar said, you know, he throw me a pass, and he said, if you don't know what to do with it, shoot it or give it back to me. I know what to do with it. So he said, just shoot it or you give it back to me. And that cut down on my mistakes, I tell you that, on offense. The last shot, throw it to the guy that makes the most money. You know,
well,
you got
share with us that very humorous but true story. One day, I think you said after practice, you were cornered by two of the greatest of all time, Oscar Robertson and Kareem, and they cornered you and said what?
They said, all right, the last shot in the game, you got the ball, who do you give it to? And I said, Kareem, you know, I'm scared of both of them, really. And I said, give it to Kareem. Oscar said, that's right, you give it to the guy that makes the most money.
Boy, I tell you, that was a tremendous team. Talk about that team and your march through the playoffs and actually winning it all.
Well, they had won it all the year before I got there with Greg Smith other forward on the other side of Dandridge. So when he got traded to Houston, I was a throw-in in the deal. They traded Greg Smith to Houston for a first-round draft choice. And I wasn't very productive in Houston, and I wasn't very popular with the coach, who was Tex Winter at the time, the father of the triangle offense. It wasn't Bill Jackson. It was Tex Winter out of Kansas State.
Why was that?
There was no by the time we got to Houston, we had got Cliff Mealy in the draft, and he was considered the prototype for what Tex wanted for his offense. I hadn't played much the year before in San Diego, and I didn't get much of a chance in Houston. Rudy Tomjanovich and Cliff Mealy got the playing time mainly at forward. So I became expendable, and instead of waiving me, Milwaukee said they weren't really that set up front, and they'd take a look at me. Wayne Embry was friends with the great Pete Newell, and Pete Newell was the one that drafted me to San Diego, and he was really high on me. And so they took a chance, and I always felt I had something to prove at Milwaukee because they had won the championship with Greg Smith, and people were talking about how it was a really bad trade to trade away somebody from a championship team for this guy who hadn't played. I didn't even have a name on the back of my uniform. You know, but I got to play in another one of the greatest games on in the NBA history. When I first got there, I started against the Lakers, who had won 33 in a row. And I did pretty good in that game. And, so exposure, playing time. I was the rebounder that could free up Kareem from some of that kind of duties. And I could defend the DeBushers and the other big power. Well, they weren't called power forwards. They were just the big forward. Yeah, the big forward and the small forward. And then those that played all kinds of positions. So I could defend Dave DeBuscher, who gave the Bucks fits because he could overpower Greg Smith. And Dandridge would be guarding Bill Bradley, Senator Bill Bradley, who was on the Knicks that year. Phil Jackson was on the Knicks and coming off the bench. And Happy Harrison, I could defend him at the Lakers. And Boston had Satch Sanders and Paul Silas and Don Nelson. So I was a good fit on the other side of Dandridge. And Lucius Allen and Oscar Robertson handled the guard position. And pretty good center. So that was the chemistry makeup of the Bucks for that time. And we did okay. We won. I was there for 3 years and won 60 games 2 years and 59 the next.
Wow, so, that's pretty good. That's very.
We lost to Boston in the championship and. Another classic, the sixth game when Abdul-Jabbar hits a hook with 2 seconds to go on the clock to send the series to a seventh game back in Milwaukee. There have been some great games that I was fortunate enough to be a part of.
Yeah. We're going to talk about another great game and some of the pundits who follow basketball throughout the years, they've labeled this game the greatest game of all time. But before we talk about that, talk about the greatness of Oscar Robertson. Because at that point, Oscar had adjusted his game. I mean, he wasn't scoring as many points as he did initially, but he was still a very effective player. Talk about his ability to lead a team.
Well, this is this I think is lost sometimes on the really new basketball players. People have come to basketball in the age of television. There were great players before Magic and Bird, not putting anybody down. You know, there was no real talk of who's the greatest ever. If you win 8 or 9 championships in a row, you should be in the conversation. You know, Oscar won 1 championship with the Bucks. But Bill Russell considered him the greatest. And if the greatest winner in professional basketball history thinks that Oscar Robertson was the greatest, I just consider that who's the best ever sports bar talk. You know, you get in a fight arguing over LeBron James and Michael Jordan. I don't see any point in that. But they had to widen the lane to make it more difficult for Wilt Chamberlain. And he averaged 50 points a game. Why isn't he in the conversation? Oscar was at the end of his career, but he was so basketball smart. He could make the best of any situation out there. And our coach was Larry Costello, who Oscar used to make a living off of playing against when Larry was playing for Philadelphia. You respect that intelligence, that knowledge, that savvy, that understanding of how to play the game. I think that the way the game is played now is so much different. The way the game is coached now is so much different. And talking about the end of the big man era in basketball, well, that's ridiculous. You mean to tell me Wilt couldn't play in this era because he didn't have a three-point shot? You know, give me a break. What is the way that the game is coached and played? That's the difference really now. The era was important because when I came in, it was transitioning from the Wilts and Russells and Havlicek's and Lenny Wilkins, maybe not household names, but these guys knew how to play. You won't find a better point guard than Lenny Wilkins.
I agree.
A great, great player and player coaches back then. Lenny Wilkins, Bill Russell, Richie Guerin from the St. Louis Hawks. I don't think you're gonna find any player coaches anymore ever.
No, I don't think that's
the thing that is.
Well,
bad.
Curtis, not officially now. I mean, somebody said that LeBron has been a player coach most of his career.
Yeah. Oh, but, and rightly so. I mean, the guy has lived up to the hype. One of the few that have lived up to the hype from the time that they started playing basketball until.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a basketball IQ that's out of this world.
He certainly does. Now, let's talk about going to another team, fitting in, and producing exceptionally well, the Phoenix Suns. Talk about that team, and then, of course, what others have said, and I concur, and we alluded to it just a moment ago. You participated, and I watched it right here in my den. I watched it, and I'm saying, wow, what a game against the Boston Celtics. Folks are saying the greatest game ever.
Well, that year was my second year. The 1975-76 season was my second year in Phoenix. I had a career year the year before in points and rebounds. I was the number 10 rebounder in the league in the 74-75 season. And Charlie Scott was the all-star. And that summer, he'd been traded to the Boston Celtics for Paul Westphal. And the Suns used the first-round draft choice for Ricky Sobers out of UNLV.
Yes.
The other forward starting alongside me was Mike Banham.
Mm.
Great player. Great
yes,
player.
He was. Yeah.
Had been on that 72 Olympic team in Munich that had been cheated by the Russians. And John McLeod was the coach. And we didn't have a very good season. I think we were like 32-50 that year. But the next year, when Westfall came and Alvin Adams, who is another one of the most underrated players in NBA history, and Mike Bantam and John Shumate was on the team from Notre Dame.
Yes.
We started off pretty good, and then I got hurt, and Alvin got hurt, and John McLeod made this really bold move. He traded John Shumate to Buffalo, Mike Bantam to Seattle, and from Buffalo got Garfield Hurd. Garfield Hurd was on, and Clifford Wright were on the Oklahoma team coached by John McLeod that I played against at Southwest Missouri. They were the only Big 8 team that would play us because you couldn't afford to get beat by a Division II team if you're a Big 8 team. But they beat us by like 3 points or something like that. But Garfield Hurd coming in at mid-season. The All-Star game was in Phoenix that year. Mm-hmm. And I was coming off a facial fracture, courtesy of Sam Lacy. I came to the banquet, and John McLeod was sitting at the table, called me over, and he's just smiling and big start. Hey, CP, I got your boy. Yeah, who's my boy? He said, Garfield. I got Garfield. Now, when I was in college, all you heard about was Garfield Hurd of Oklahoma and Lucius Allen, who was from Kansas City Wyandotte, and Warren Jabali, but the ones, you know, the ones in my position was Garfield Hurd. That's who was the man in the Midwest at that time. And I thought about it, and I thought maybe they were going to trade me because we kind of played the same position.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm looking over my shoulder, so to speak, but that's not going to stop me from, you know, doing my best. And John McLeod was just so eager to pair me and Garfield with Alvin Adams, who was more of a high post center, which freed Garfield and I under the boards to do lots of damage. And because Alvin would pull the center out, making it tough for anybody to go one-on-one with us down low. And one of the things that trade did, it made us a really, really powerful rebounding team. And that's what you spoke about before, getting the ball off the boards. I don't think any two forwards were going to stay on the boards with me and Garfield for a whole game. And Alvin was a really good rebounder. So we out-rebounded mostly everybody that year. And the fit made teams have to adjust to us. I think that was one of the main things that contributed to our success, with the two supposedly power forwards down low, the center at the high post, the two guards that were that could play inside and out with Westfall. And at first, Dick Van Arsdale, until he broke his arm. Mm-hmm. And then Ricky Sobers moved into the starting lineup, which created a really, really good defensive team and a great rebounding team.
Yeah.
We took off. We had the second or third best record the second half of the season because teams couldn't adjust to us. And the best series was when the Suns played the NBA champions from the year before, the Warriors, with mm-hmm. Rick Barry and Jamal Wilkes and
yeah.
Clifford Ray and Phil Smith. We took them the seventh game and beat them on their home court on the seventh game, which is also another one of the great games in the NBA history. And we thought we could beat Boston. In fact, we were pretty confident we could beat Boston if we you know, did what we did to get there. And they kicked us the first two games in Boston. And we eked out two games in Phoenix setting the stage for that June 4th game.
Mm-hmm.
Got down early by 22 points. And from then on, I had never been involved in a basketball game like that. To come from behind 22 points, take the game to three overtimes, the first three overtime finals game in NBA history. And it was a game where there were so many ups and downs and
yeah.
lead changes.
Yeah.
And you think you got it won, and then somebody hits the shot of the game. There were so many shots of the game that, and it lasted so long because one of the negatives of NBA basketball at that time, it wasn't that popular, and we, the game was tape delayed. An NBA finals game that's tape delayed. You can't even imagine that happening now.
No
prime time, no sponsors, and no Nike. Everything was Chuck Taylors and Adidas in those days. So
let me interject this real quick. Talk to us, because I'm watching the game, and some of our listeners were viewing the game as well, and I'm exhausted. But talk about the mental and the physical exhaustion after a game like that. As you said, there were so many highs and lows emotionally, where you score a bucket, you think that's it, they come back, and then from a physical standpoint, to play three overtimes in an NBA game, but not just an NBA game, but a playoff series. Man, talk about the exhaustion that is involved in that.
Well, I talked to Dave Cowens some years later at the Retired Players Association gathering, and we talked about that very thing, that one of the things that was shaping up was that somebody was going to be the hero who wasn't really a consideration, wasn't a starter, but had fresh legs.
That's right.
The game started one day and didn't end till after midnight.
I know.
And it started late, but the pace was so grueling, and it was a physical game. You bumping and running up and down the court, and one thing would lead, you know, one time you think you got the game won, and then next thing you know, you're two behind, four behind, and then you tie it up, and you go ahead, and they tie it, and it was like that just about the entire second half. So by the time you get to the first overtime, we've been going pretty strong here for a long time. The second overtime, still players are fouling out. The main players are fouling out. Alvin Adams didn't play any of the overtimes, and Paul Silas played two overtimes with five fouls on it. Dave Cowan's fouls out. So guys with fresh legs, Glenn McDonald, comes in the third overtime, scores 6 points. And that was the difference, because everybody else was exhausted. JoJo White sat down on the court. He was so tired by the third overtime. Garfield Hurd played 61 minutes.
Happy Christmas.
And I played 53.
That's unheard of these days.
And so that's like a game in a 5 minute overtime. And the pressure in that place with the big fight you had to clear the court, get Boston to come back out of the locker room because they ran in after Havlicek's shot of the game, and put 1 second back on the clock when there was supposed to be like three or four, but hey, that's Boston Gardens for you, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And the pressure shots had come up, and Garfield hit his shot of the game to tie the game up and send it into a third overtime. And we almost sent it into a fourth. If Westfall had made a steal, we could have got the ball back at the end of the third overtime. And it was just like that the entire second half. Nobody backed off. Nobody quit. But it is grueling when, like you were mentioning, the emotional drain on you added to the physical pressure and the fact that, you know, that there wasn't fresh legs out on the court. People
wow.
were dragging, but mm-hmm. nobody was quitting.
No, nobody was quitting. You know, in professional sport, if you are a historian like I am, you look at certain games. In football, it was the Ice Bowl with the Cowboys.
The Ice Bowl, yeah.
And then in baseball, you have a number of games where the Aaron Boone game against the Yankees Red Sox, or, you know, games like that. But in basketball, you go to the game that you're discussing. You are a participant, Celtics versus the Suns. Now, what about the officials? You know, talk about them, because at some point, you know, they were getting hungry and was worrying about dinner, and I don't think they were calling many fouls towards the end, were they?
There was a distinct lack of whistles in those overtime games. Because, well, Richie Powers and his infamous non-call of the Paul Silas timeout.
I'll share that with our listeners just briefly. We've got about about 10 minutes left, but share that with our listeners who may not be aware of what you're speaking of.
Well, the Suns had the last shot of the first overtime, and the play was for Garfield to throw it into me, and I was going to jump over whoever was getting it and try to get the ball close to the basket, close to the rim. Well, Dave Cowens tipped the ball, and Paul Silas turns to Richie Powers and calls timeout. Boston didn't have any timeouts. Now, that was supposed to be a technical foul.
That's
now,
right.
That's important. It was supposed to be a technical foul, and Richie Powers refused to call it because he said later, I didn't want to see the game end like that. Well, what do you mean?
Well, Curtis, on one hand, I respect his honesty and candor, but as a former basketball coach, you know, if you're an official, you're not looking at the clock. You got to call what you see.
You're absolutely right. And that was hard. What do you mean? You didn't want to see the game like that. It ain't up to you.
No.
You called the game. And that timeout called by Paul Silas that wasn't recognized was exactly what Paul Westfall called to set up the play for Garfield Hurd's great winning game time shot to send the game into the third overtime. And because the Suns didn't have any timeouts, we're 1 point down at our end of the basket, and Westfall came up with the play to call a timeout, one shot, but we get to move the ball to half court. Now, if we had taken the ball out under our basket, there's no way we could score from our end down to the other end of the court in 1 second after they'd run a couple off, of course. But, you know, it would have to be like that Duke-Kentucky play. You had to throw it all the way down court and hope somebody could do a Christian Laettner and catch it and turn around and shoot it, which wasn't going to be possible in a professional game.
No.
But from half court, we did have a shot. And that timeout was crucial that it get recognized. So they get the one shot, they go two up, and Garfield ties the game, sends it into the third overtime. But Richie Powers didn't recognize the same timeout situation with Paul Silas would have sent Westfall to the line with no time on the clock for a free throw, which would have given the Suns the win. We would have won the fifth game had Richie Powers recognized that timeout. And Al Bianchi, bless his heart and rest in peace, he had a championship ring on it, ring made with the inscription inside with bless you, Richie Powers.
But
let's just say that blessing was kind of an expletive deleted.
just like in baseball up in New England, when they mention the name of Bucky Dent, they put a, put a little
bless
something
you.
In front of Bucky.
You, Bucky Dent.
That's right. That's right. Curtis Perry, we've got a few minutes left, and all the guests that appear in the Coach's Corner, I always ask them to leave out listeners with some parting shots, words of wisdom. And looking at your story, the other day we had Muggsy Bogues on, 5'3", played 12-plus years or more in the NBA. Tremendous story. You, as you stated, wasn't the most gifted or talented player, but yet you made it to the highest level and contributed. Talk about how determination and work ethic can take you to places that you couldn't imagine, and then also talk about how that work ethic and determination helped you beyond the court.
Well, one of the things that I have noticed is these comparisons to an NBA player will come in and say, well, he's going to be the next Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, LeBron James. I never thought in those terms. I was going to be the best Curtis Perry that I could be. There's only one Michael Jordan. There's only one Bill Russell. There's only one Dale Schluter, you know, in the, that ever played in the NBA. If you work at it, if you put the time and the sweat into it and the determination, I mean, be the best player you can be, no matter what your name is. You can mold yourself or pick up pointers from people who have done it before you. But you're not going to have the greatest sky hook that ever was in the NBA, but you can be the best basketball, baseball, football, hockey, soccer player. Mm-hmm. You can be. It's a matter of how your desire to improve will motivate you to do your best. No taking time off to admire where you come from or how far you come, because there's always, always somebody that can step in and take your place. Always somebody.
Always someone that can step in and take your place. Well, I tell you
always.
What. No one could have taken your place today in this very informative and enjoyable one-on-one. Curtis Perry, thank you for the visit inside of the locker room in the Coach's Corner. Appreciate you, man.
Anytime, my man. Anytime at all.
All right.
Good to hear you. Good to speak to the folks back in the hometown again. And in these days, you got to keep your faith. You got to keep your faith.
And we will do that. Hey, Curtis, thanks a lot, my man. Godspeed.
Thank you, sir.
All right. And, folks, that was Curtis Perry. And I tell you, boy, I really enjoyed that. And tomorrow we will have Lloyd Walton. Lloyd Walton, former NBA player out of Chicago, Marquette. In the Coach's Corner, so Lloyd Walton. But I want to thank my super producer, Rick Hampton Sr. of the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. I want to thank Horton's Funeral Service for over 80 years. They're simply the best. They're located 600 Kennedy Street Northwest. Give them a call at 202-829-9000. That's 202-829-9000 and ask for Randolph Horton. And Dr. Edward T. Buford, give him a call, 202-667-8818. Again, 202-667-8818. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's show. And tomorrow, as I said, at 7 p.m., we're going to have Lloyd Walton aboard. And then on Thursday, we'll have the Duck, Donald Duck Williams of Mackin and Notre Dame and NBA fame. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid.